from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, in response to what NATO Secretary General is calling Russian aggression in eastern Ukraine, NATO wants to establish a new force of several thousand troops capable of being deployed within 48 hours anywhere within the alliance. The force is expected to be approved at a NATO summit to take place later this week in Wales. Meanwhile, President Obama is heading to the region today, and in the hour ahead, we'll discuss the latest developments in Ukraine. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. NATO estimates that at least 1,000 Russian soldiers are in Ukraine, even though Russia denies any military involvement in the fighting that has so far claimed 2,600 lives. That's according to United Nations figures. Russia has been accused of flagrant violation of Ukrainian sovereignty, and on Saturday, the European Union, which requires unanimous support for additional sanctions beyond those already imposed on Russia, appeared poised to take action and ready to impose more sanctions. With Ukrainian forces losing more ground. On Sunday, Russia's President Vladimir Putin, who has called the southeast region of Russia, where Russia activists continue to rebel against Ukraine, New Russia, asked for talks to begin on statehood for that region. Putin also praised Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko as a viable partner. This morning's opening forum hour, we want to turn our attention once again to the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. Joining us from Ukraine, from Kyiv, is David Stern. He's Kyiv correspondent for the BBC. David Stern, welcome. Good to have you.
Hello there.
Hi. I guess the place to begin is with what's happening now. I'm being fed information about 100 Ukrainian troops being killed right there.
Well, yes, there was fighting over the weekend. It all started with an area in the east, a village called Ilovaisk, where there were Ukrainian troops who had been surrounded by the rebels and the Russian fighters. They apparently suffered very heavy losses during the encirclement, and then there was an agreement reached where they would leave the town through a humanitarian corridor. What the Ukrainians are saying is that they were fired upon. They were given safe passage, but the rebels went back on that promise and trapped them. There are possibly, and these are unconfirmed figures, as many as 100 people that were killed just during that that ambush. And the figures overall in the encirclement and otherwise were much, much higher.
How many of these rebels are indeed rebels with Ukrainian mooring, and how many of them can we assess? For example, we're hearing out of Russia that these are, if there are any Russians involved in this, they're on leave or they're taking their vacation or things of that sort.
Well, yes. Okay. First of all, it's very difficult to say how many Russians are there and how many Russian troops. But let's just start with the Russians. There's a significant number of Russian citizens who are fighting among the rebels. The rebels admit to this. They say 3,000 to 4,000. The numbers vary, but they've also said that they've had 1,200 to come at any one time. And they've also said that these Russians have been trained in Russia. So there's no question that there is Russian involvement, not just Russian citizen. But bear in mind, Russia is a place where you're not going to be carrying out training camps for 4 months without the tacit approval of the authorities. So the very fact that they're coming over the border means that Russia is involved, despite Russia's denials. Then there's the question of actual Russian troops, and what it appears is the figure of 1,000 is actually quite conservative. I've heard much higher from NATO and from Ukrainian officials, but they're using the conservative because this they feel they can actually prove without a doubt. And there does seem to be more actual Russian troops coming over the border. Again, the Russians deny this, but the rebels, as you alluded there, have said that they do have they have Russian soldiers among them. They're just on vacation, which, American officials have pointed out, the American UN ambassador, soldiers on vacation are still soldiers.
David Stern with us from Kyiv. He is a journalist and Kyiv correspondent for the BBC. David, what's been the response in Kiev to the remarks that were allegedly made by President Putin to Jose Manuel Barroso over the weekend? Barroso, of course, a European commissioner, and President Putin was very indignant because apparently this diplomat said that he had been told by President Putin that he could take Kiev in 2 weeks.
Exactly. Now, it's not quite clear exactly how this what was said, and the Russians have said that it was taken out of context, and it's possible that there was a slightly different context. For instance, what Mr. Putin could have said was, we have no Russian troops in Russia. If I had Russian troops there, I could take Kiev in 2 weeks. But obviously, he's implying that they very well could, if they wanted to, they could do it. The reaction to that in particular hasn't been that strong. They've heard a lot from Moscow. And again, you mentioned earlier Mr. Putin talking about statehood for Novorossiya, for New Russia. This was something new. Now, again, the Russians backtracked on that as well and said that they didn't actually mean actual independence. But the fact that he actually said it meant it was, you know, as we say, out there. It's now in the public domain and people are discussing it. So there's a lot. The Ukrainians are more concerned what they call a great war. They say Russia is fighting a major war against them, and they are very worried about this.
They are calling it a war in Kiev as opposed to an invasion or an incursion or a face-off or all these other characterizations that we hear?
Well, they're using all those words and a lot of other ones, I can guarantee you. The defense minister said yesterday that they're fighting a great war. Now, what he probably meant was that if this continues, it will be a major war in Europe. As he put it, the biggest war since World War II. And there are experts that say the same thing, that this ultimately is potentially, if Ukraine refuses to give in to Russia, that this could turn into something much greater, tens of thousands, if not more, killed during this conflict.
David Stern again with us in Kiev, Kiev correspondent for the BBC. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Also, let me tell you who is with us for the hour. Edward Walker here in studio with us is adjunct professor of political science with UC Berkeley. He blogs at eurasiangeopolitics.com. And Ned Walker, good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
I'd like you to hear first and get your response to what NATO Secretary General Rasmussen said earlier today.
Honestly speaking, we must face the reality that Russia does not consider NATO a partner. We can see in Russian military documents, we can listen to statements from Russian political leaders that they consider NATO an adversary.
Well, when I heard that at first, I said, duh. You know, I mean, it's fairly obvious that this is the way Russia feels about NATO. I mean, they've been trying to create their own alliance, and that gets us into the whole nature. I want to get your response to what the Secretary General just said, but gets us into this whole murky realm of what are the objectives or motives of President Putin in all this. I mean, he clearly doesn't want Ukrainian autonomy. He clearly wants to have the kind of influence he had before. At the same time, he's saying, no, I don't want to necessarily take over Ukraine, although I keep reminding my listeners he once said not too long ago that the breakup of the USSR was the biggest tragedy of the 20th century. What do you think he's after here?
Well, that's a very difficult question. But my position from the beginning is that it's safest to assume that what he says is and has been saying for quite a long time is more or less what he's primarily interested in, which is keeping Ukraine out of, above all, out of NATO and out of the Western institutional orbit. And it is certainly true that what Rasmussen said today is correct, that for a very long time, basically from its inception, the Russians have perceived NATO expansion as a threat to their security, going back to the early 1990s. And that perception has just deepened over time to the point where, I think they have tried to signal to the West for quite some period that Ukraine and Georgia joining NATO are more or less red lines for them. And certainly the war in 2008 in Georgia, in my view, was intended above all to be a very strong message to the West that NATO expansion has gone far enough and we're not going to we have the power to stop it now, and we will stop it.
I wonder what we learned from Georgia, I mean, particularly in light of what the U.S. and the West is facing now. Isn't it also, though, possible that what Putin wants here is a land route to Crimea?
That's certainly possible. I mean, the situation now, it's, you know, just been getting more and more dangerous and you know, no signs of de-escalation. And the real, I mean, one real question at the moment is how far does this, the Russian offensive, and I think that's a proper way to characterize it, is going to stop? And what are their, what are the intended borders at which they plan to end? And there are many different possibilities, but the I would say the minimum one is a, an area that they control, that they establish operational control of around Lugansk and Donetsk, and pushing the Ukrainian forces back out of those areas, although exactly how far is unclear. But the other possibility is that this latest movement down in the south near the Sea of Azov is intended to be eventually expanded past the city of Mariupol, which is a large city, and then presumably extend all the way to Crimea, with the possibility that there'll be Russian forces coming out of Crimea to join up with an assault from the east. So, the you know, the point is we don't know. We don't know what the intentions are, and we, you know, at some point, presumably, hopefully, that will become clear, and then the next question will be, you know, how to arrange a ceasefire, and then the question after that will be how to, you know, what are the political arrangements for maintaining a line of control along the ceasefire line, and then what's going to be the status of this area that that Russians control.
Well, in the meantime, they've been talking over the weekend about putting even more bite and more harsh sanctions. And what kind of a effect is this having? It's certainly hurting, to a degree, the Russian economy. And if it's going to be even more harsh, it will hurt more.
Well, absolutely. My view is that the Russian economy was in pretty serious trouble even before all of this. The whole sanctions question is quite unusual because Russia is an advanced economy. Quite wealthy. It's a high middle income country now, with a very sophisticated banking system. You know, it's not Iran. It's now not South Africa at the time of apartheid, and it's you know, a country that runs on finance, or to which finance is extremely important.
And a country which has a lot of oil,
right? Energy and you know, oil and gas exports and other commodities. But it, you know, it's in my view, very vulnerable to sanctions. And there was a growth crisis in Russia even before all of this. And you know, I think it's going to get worse.
And what do you think is going to be accomplished by President Obama going to Estonia? I mean, this is a message to the Baltic republics, isn't it?
It's certainly support. Intended yeah. to be. No question about that. And obviously, everyone will be watching exactly what Obama says. The underlying problem is that it's extremely difficult in practice, I think, to see how NATO can actually defend Estonia and Latvia in particular. They're very small countries right on the border of Russia. They have virtually no military capacity of their own. There's almost no – there, at least until recently, almost no actual NATO presence in those two countries. You know, they're extremely vulnerable. If worse comes to worse and things continue to ratchet up, which I don't think is going to happen but might – you know, we're in a very – I mean, the NATO is in a very difficult position in trying to defend Estonia and Latvia in particular.
Well, what does it mean when NATO says, as they just did over the weekend, that they're going to put a new force of several thousand troops capable of being deployed within 48 hours anywhere within the alliance?
Well, it's obvious and I think appropriate that NATO takes steps now to improve the credibility of its defenses along its eastern border. You know, I think eventually it's going to be important that there be, you know, some kind of agreement with Russia where there's sort of credible deterrence on both sides of whatever the military line of separation is between Russia and NATO. And that's something we're going to have to work out over a very long period of time. But in the interim, our the credibility of NATO's defenses in the East, particularly in the Baltic states, is very weak. And I think this is a small step. It's not a major step towards enhancing those deterrence capabilities.
Again, our guest in studio is Edward W. Walker. He's adjunct professor of political science at UC Berkeley and blogs at EurasianGeopolitics.com. We're talking about the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. When you mentioned Georgia before, it also made me think of the fact that, of course, it was back in 2008, and Putin sort of realized as a result of that that maybe all he needed to do was bide his time. I mean, putting it bluntly, that's according to some analysts and the way they see things. If he wants Ukraine, and again, we don't know what his objectives are. Maybe what he wants here is just to foment a rebellion in East Ukraine, which would give them less autonomy and less link to NATO and the EU. But maybe he just has to bide his time.
The way I interpreted the war in 2008 was that was a war that was deliberately provoked by Russia as a signal to the West after the West's decision to recognize Kosovo, and then in particular after the decision in early 2008 to eventually offer Georgia and Ukraine at some point indeterminate in the future NATO and membership, that is not going to happen, that Russia was not going to allow that. And so I think from his perspective and the perspective of the people around him, that was a huge warning. And they hoped that the West had understood that. But they interpreted the EU accession agreement for Ukraine at the end of last year as a kind of indication that message had not been received. And I think that was one of the reasons why they were so so determined to keep EU from, Ukraine from signing that EU accession agreement, because they viewed that as basically the first step towards the full-blown incorporation of Ukraine into the Western institutional orbit, including NATO. And so from their perspective, these sort of red line warnings had not been picked up in the West, and they reacted accordingly.
Edward Walker, again, adjunct professor of political science, UC Berkeley, and blogs at EurasianGeopolitics.com. We want to get Michael McFaul on with us now. He's a political scientist at Stanford and former U.S. ambassador to Russia. Mike McFaul, welcome. Good to have you back on Forum.
Thanks for having me.
I guess we're talking here about what Russia's objectives are, what Putin's objectives are really in this ongoing invasion, incursion, war, whatever. We've been failing to characterize it, and it has many ways of signifying what it is. But I'd like to get a read from you on what you think his objectives are and what kind of leverage the West has in addition to the kind of sanctions that are at least being talked about being increased now.
Well, I don't think he's decided exactly what his objectives are, and I think over the last several weeks they've changed. If you were to go back 4 months, you would have heard him use the phrase Nova Russia for the first time, where he talked about the mistake that the Bolsheviks made in giving away these regions, these eastern regions of Ukraine, to the Ukrainian Republic of the Soviet Union. But then he backed away from that. He didn't acknowledge the referendum. He recognized the election of President Poroshenko. And it looked for a time that he was kind of giving up on the rebels. And the Ukrainian forces, two or three weeks ago, were winning. I think he then calculated it was he did not want them to win. He decided to up the ante. And now the Russian backside is winning in a pretty dramatic way, by the way. They've made some real territorial gains. And now I think Putin's deciding what he wants to do. Is he going to settle for some kind of negotiation between the quote-unquote governments in the East, or will he actually go forward and recognize independence as they want? I don't think he's decided yet, but he's in a much stronger position now than he was just two or three weeks ago.
And maybe moving closer to being, at least in his own mind, as you point out in your article, a reincarnation of either Peter or Catherine the Great?
Well, in his own mind. History will judge whether this was wise or not, depending on how it all ends. I could see this ending in a very bad way for the Russian economy, for Russia's standing in the world. But in his own mind, those are the people that he most certainly compares himself to.
But what do we have in the way, as far as we in the West, of leverage here? As I said, there's talk over the weekend of increasing and making more harsh the sanctions. And also over the weekend, curiously enough, I'm sure you're well aware that President Putin said that he said some rather favorable things about President Poroshenko and could see him as a viable partner and was talking about, statehood talks.
Well, with respect to your first question about leverage, the answer is there aren't good options. The West, the Obama administration, NATO, the rest of Europe do not have great instruments to try to influence Putin's behavior. I think most certainly when the president arrives at the NATO summit, there'll be discussions of new sanctions, and that will go forward. But the impact of that on Putin's decision-making, I think, needs to be measured in months or years, not weeks or months. Second, there'll be a debate about increased military assistance to Ukraine. I think, remember, Poroshenko will be at the summit. The NATO-Ukraine Council will meet. And if he does make certain requests, I think there'll be a lot of pressure on the alliance to meet that. But again, I'm not sure that that will change things on the ground in the short term. The optimistic point to your second question, yes, Putin did say he could work with Poroshenko. And in the meetings that were held in Minsk a few days ago, where representatives of these alleged governments, these independent governments from Donetsk and Luhansk, they did hint at the possibility that they could be within a united Ukraine. I don't know if that's a bargaining position or where, you know, I don't want to read too much into one meeting, but it was cautiously positive signs that there might be a deal to be made.
There is a perhaps objective in this of just taking stress off the rebels and limiting the authority or the autonomy that Kiev has with respect to Russian influence. I mean, it's pretty clear that President Putin does not want Ukraine to join NATO or the EU, and he's nervous probably, isn't he? We can assume because of Belarus and Kazakhstan.
Well, most certainly a minimalist objective of Putin will be to make sure that Ukraine does not join NATO. And by having parts of the Ukrainian state under a situation of contested sovereignty, that'll make it impossible for Ukraine to join NATO. That's exactly, as Ned was describing earlier, that's exactly what happened with Georgia in 2008. So he can achieve that objective without going forward to, you know, independence or annexation of these parts of Ukraine. I do want to remind people, though, that there was never a threat, in my opinion, that Ukraine was going to join NATO. That debate ended long ago. There has been no eastern movement of NATO over the last several years. Putin has made this an issue in reaction to what he did in Ukraine. But to go back to the analytics, I most certainly believe that that is a minimalist objective that he wants to achieve with these actions.
Michael McFaul with us from Stanford, political scientist there and former U.S. ambassador to Russia. And you can join us if you have something you'd like to add to this conversation. If you have a question or a comment, please feel free to join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, the number for your calls, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum, but please feel free to join us. You're invited to do so. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. NATO has accused Russia of violating Ukrainian sovereignty by sending equipment and combat troops into eastern Ukraine to support pro-Russian rebels, and Russia denies this. In response, European leaders have essentially said that they will further the sanctions that have already been taken against Russia. We're talking about the latest developments in Ukraine. We spoke earlier with David Stern, who is Kiev correspondent for the BBC, and Ned Walker's with us. He's adjunct professor of political science at UC Berkeley and blogs at EurasianGeopolitics.com. And Michael McFaul with us as well, political scientist at Stanford and former U.S. ambassador to Russia. I'm going to go right to your phone calls here. I just wonder, Ambassador McFaul, interested in hearing Your take on, well, he's not here to respond, but just Stephen Cohen's interpretation of what's going on here, which is has a lot more to do with Ukrainians and the United States in some ways being in collusion against Putin. I know I'm kind of being reductive in the way I'm describing that, but in other words, a lot of this conflict, as Steve Cohen sees things, has to do with U.S. involvement and U.S. manipulation and really a pro-Western Ukrainian government that has also been culpable of much and needs to be seen as culpable of much.
Yeah, I know Professor Cohen's views, Steve's views. I've known him for a long time, and I disagree with his analysis. I just remind your listeners that when the Obama administration first came to office in 2009, I was part of the team. I worked at the White House for 3 years before going to Moscow. We had a policy called the reset, where we tried to reset relations with Russia in ways that we thought were win-win outcomes for Russia and the United States. And we achieved a lot. We signed a New START treaty. We put in place sanctions against Iran, opened up supply routes to Afghanistan through Russia, got Russia into the World Trade Organization, and I could go on. It was a time of lots of cooperation. And at the height of that, by the way, two-thirds of the Russian people had a very positive view of the United States. What changed was Putin's attitude towards the United States. When he decided to run for office, to come back for a third term, he needed an enemy, again, to mobilize his electoral base. Remember, there were demonstrations against his regime back in December 2011. They started then. And in my opinion, it was his actions that put us back into this much more confrontational policy. We didn't change our policy. We didn't change anything. He was the one that changed. And, you know, with respect to pushing against Russia and all those things, I just remind your listeners, there was no push eastward of NATO at the time. That didn't happen until, it's not happening now, but the confrontation about that only happened after this current very tragic conflict over Ukraine.
Well, in the recent article of yours that I read over the weekend, you were talking about Putin gaining international stature, keeping Assad in power, doing things that really, like the Sochi Olympics, were supposed to be redounding to his advantage, and even Edward Snowden could be put into that calculus. But you also say that, he squandered those gains and that there's much more failure than there is, on the positive side.
Yeah, that's my view. Now, if I were president of Russia, I would have very different objectives in terms of what I would want to see. I would want to see a strong, democratic, market-oriented country integrating with the West, right? But even by the definition of Putin's own objectives for Russia, I think this latest intervention in Ukraine really wastes a lot of progress, frankly, that he had made before then. And you're right to talk about all those things. He'd actually put together a really curious international coalition. On the one hand, he was the champion of non-interventionists and kind of the anti-imperialists. And on the other hand, he put together a very interesting coalition of conservative politicians, social movements, religious movements, where he was the conservative reaction or conservative check on what he called the decadent liberal West. Really interesting that you could put those two groups together, by the way. That's no more. I think, if you look at any opinion polls that have been done recently, Russia's image in the world has plummeted. And neither of those two coalitions that used to be somewhat sympathetic to Putin are as sympathetic as they used to be.
Michael McFaul, former U.S. ambassador to Russia, is political scientist at Stanford, and Edward W. Walker is adjunct professor of political science at UC Berkeley. I'm going to get to our callers and emailers here, but Ned Walker, just to get your take on this, in his article that I mentioned here, Michael McFaul says, failures are dominant for Putin because the biggest one was not getting the Ukraine to join the Eurasian Union, and Crimea sealed that, and then, of course, Yanukovych was driven out. In other words, all this, but notwithstanding, he's still extremely popular in Russia because of this nationalistic fervor.
Well, the domestic fallout of this is going to take some time to play out, and I expect that his I'm very confident that his very high approval ratings now are going to start to fall again.
Because of the sanctions and because of the economic?
Yes, and the sort of the perception that the cost of digesting all of this is going to be very high. And then above all, because the economy is going to continue, I think, to struggle, if not worse. The other thing I would just add to what Mike said is that impact of this adverse impact for Russian foreign policy is that I think it's greatly alarmed its neighbors, including some of Russia's, so-called allies, particularly Kazakhstan, but also even Belarus. And I think a country to watch carefully over the next several years is Belarus and how Belarus plays all of the game as it goes forward. But, in general, this has to raise the concern level all around Russia's borders and governments and its neighboring states. Though, let me just make one other point about what Mike said and just a mild disagreement. It was, of course, true that there was no political momentum for NATO accession for Georgia or Ukraine prior to all of this, but neither was there any kind of institutionalized solution to their status. No broad agreement with Russia on a kind of new security architecture for the region that sort of harks back to where we were in the late Cold War era with the Helsinki Accords and so forth. And I think the West didn't fully appreciate the extent of Russia's military concerns, and that while we focused on a political reset and on economic relations, there should have been more effort directed towards coming to an arrangement with them on security issues that we could have lived with, or we all could have lived with, including the Russians.
And go to your calls. We begin, Philip, with you. Good morning. You're on the air on Forum.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen. I have read that the Ukrainian government is very authoritarian and very corrupt, and they do not allow for more of a federated system such as we have. We can elect our own mayors. We can elect our own representatives to Sacramento. We can elect our own senators. We can elect our own representatives that go to Washington to represent us. Is a more federated system possible in Ukraine where the eastern provinces have more say over their own future?
Michael McFaul.
Well, Ukraine is not a federation. So Ukraine is a unitary state, and the United States is a federation, and that would require changes in the Constitution. I don't see positive and negatives. There's a big debate about the uses and abuses of federalism. In fact, Ned has written about it. But that's a decision that Ukrainians should decide, not pressured from an external power like Russia to decide. I also think it is a paradox that Russia actually is a federation. It's called formally the Russian Federation. And there was a time when governors were elected, when mayors were elected, and that there was more the representatives were elected in free and fair elections from the various regions of Russia. That has all been rolled back by Vladimir Putin.
You want to say something here, Ned?
Yeah, just to add something to what Mike said, which is that in my view, Russia couldn't really care less about whether Ukraine is a federation or not. What they really want is an arrangement where, the sort of more pro-Russian, eastern-leaning parts of Ukraine, in effect, can exercise a veto over the external orientation and alliances of Ukraine. That's the position that they took in Transnistria. That's the position that they've taken in other of these so-called frozen conflicts. And so basically it's a kind of federation where you can imagine all of the states of the United States had veto power over American foreign policy and alliance systems. That's what they're really pushing for, because driving this, again, in my view, is this whole vision that Russia has a right to basically a sphere of influence, or if you prefer, a hegemony in the areas along its borders, and that is a threat and also wrongful for the West to basically invade its space.
Mitt Romney's suddenly looking more prescient, isn't he? When he ran for president, they were making fun of the fact that he sounded retro, like an old Cold Warrior talking about Russia being the biggest threat. But here we are. Let me go to more of your calls. Let me get to Carl on next. Carl, you're on.
Yeah, thanks. I have a big interest in Ukraine. I've been 16 times to Moscow and Ukraine since 96. I really love those people. And it's been frustrating because anybody who's watched the news and watched Putin like I have, as has been said, he's prepared for this situation. He has, like Hitler did in his buildup, has taken over all the major media. You know, the journalists here talk about state-controlled media in Russia. There is no independent media to speak of except very small, low-circulation newspapers. All the national networks have been taken over, and that's 10 years ago. But yet, although the State Department in their own cables was calling the Kremlin a mafia state, they don't explain it to the American people what's been happening over there. And, you know, it's like the bully on the street. We know that we are stronger than Putin. NATO is 10 times more stronger militarily than Putin, although there may be some short-term issues about getting power over there. But the only way to stop a bully is to let him know that you're willing to fight, and he knows that you're stronger than he is. Period.
Okay. I thank you for that comment. We'll let it stand. We'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Berkeley. Rosalie, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, this is Rosalina. I am a Crimean-born Russian native speaker, and, of course, situation in Ukraine and Crimea concerns me significantly. Recently, last week, a major deal by German government was approved between Russian and German oil companies, and it is $7 billion deal that would promote a major influx of capital into Russia. It is in a major conflict with European sanctions. I wonder what Ambassador and other guests think about this, and why the media doesn't cover this issue.
Now, Rosalina, thank you for bringing that up. Actually, Ambassador McFaul, I'm curious to know not only what you think about that, but this, what's happened to this special relationship between Russia and Germany as things have progressed and gotten worse. Angela Merkel's efforts to do something about Crimea have failed, and so where are we?
Well, with respect to the particulars of that investment, I'm not aware of that. I would just point out that sanctions do not prohibit investments yet. They prohibit some other things in terms of lending to companies that if they're on the sanctions list in the future, but they don't prohibit that yet. That may change in the coming week. With respect to German-Russian relations, it's clear they have never been worse than now. And Chancellor Merkel knows Putin better than any other world leader, in my view, has worked hard to try to defuse this crisis in a way that it doesn't go off the rails and creates long-term negative consequences for both Russia and Europe. But if you look at her comments today, most recently over the weekend, and people in her party and people in her government, that special relationship, in their view, is over. What it means in terms of sanctions is a different matter because there are German companies that do not want to see business interrupted. I suspect there'll be a negotiation over that. I'm sure that's happening right now in the run-up to the NATO summit. But to call it something special and something different, I think that era has passed.
We're ratcheting up our energy exports as a result of the sanctions. Germany was very dependent upon Russia.
And they still are and will remain dependent on Russia for a long time to come. But remember, Russia is also dependent on Germany. You cut off those flows of energy, oil and gas in particular, when speaking about Germany, those are revenues that are lost in Russia as well.
Let me thank the caller and move on to more of your calls. Roman, you're on with us. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for having me on the program. So over the past month, almost every day, I've seen headlines in American media about Russian troops crossing the border into Ukraine. My question is, has there been actual proof, as in solid photos or videos that show active Russian troops that belong to the regular Russian army that have crossed the border into Ukraine? Mm-hmm. There have been satellite images that have been posted, but those have not been verified. So if the Russian army is actually in Ukraine, why hasn't anybody posted a picture?
And why has there been continued denial from Russia, Ned Walker?
Hmm? Well, the fact is that Russia is still more or less, although this is less and less the case, I believe, trying not to make its the presence of regular Russian military in eastern Ukraine obvious, and so they don't wear regular uniforms with it. They wear regular uniforms. They don't have insignia on them. But I've seen and watched a lot of the video evidence, and there's tons of it now, just an enormous amount. Coming out of the conflict zone.
We've seen some of these so-called little green men again?
Yes. For a long time we didn't, and I blogged about that, and I said that for a long time there was no evidence of actual regular Russian military. And now my view is that that evidence has gotten pretty clear. There's interviews with local people who say all of a sudden we're seeing people who are much better disciplined, much better equipped, polite, well trained, full kit, special force Spetsnaz guys, basically, present in the conflict zone. Ukrainian military sources now are saying increasingly. I mean, the guys who are actually doing the fighting, and you see lots of interviews with them, are saying more and more of the people that we're capturing are Russians. Some of them are Russian regulars. They did capture 10 regular Russian Spetsnaz guys and just return them to Russia and a deal with Russia. The Russians claim that they got lost. Seems rather implausible, to say the least. My sense, not the kind of thing that that you can just prove with a particular picture, because they're not that's not overt. It's not they're not with full insignia, and they haven't declared war, and they haven't and they also haven't engaged. It is important to appreciate that the extent of the involvement is still very limited from Russia's standpoint. If they really wanted to attack full bore Ukraine, the level of violence would be a great deal higher. You'd see aviation, you'd see deep strikes against the rear. It could be a whole lot worse. So far, they're still more or less trying to keep it masked, and they're just trying to push the Ukrainian forces back. Exactly how far is not clear.
I should mention that we are getting some response from a few listeners saying that this is a one-sided discussion. Looking at an email here from a listener named Harshad, who says, "We've never heard firsthand from the Russian or the rebel perspective. All we hear are the Western stereotypical perspectives. Is this Cold War propaganda again?"
There's a, I'm not talking about, obviously Mike was an American ambassador. So
that doesn't make me a Cold War propagandist, though.
No, exactly. And I'm an academic, and I see my
– So is Mike,
of course. Yes.
So
but
am
anyway,
I.
I view my role in this is to try to get at the facts as best as I can. There's an enormous amount of material on the web who's, anybody or just, many, many Russian spokesmen are given plenty of access to American media. You can watch RT.
We've
had
them on forum. We certainly have had strong Russian enthusiasts and supporters here. But
and you can watch RT, which is basically relentless pro-Russian.
That's true. I'm sorry, Mike McFaul, you want to add something here?
Well, just a couple things. First, with respect to the issue we're discussing, I would just note that you don't have to take Ned's word for it. The UN ambassador from Russia, Vitaly Churkin, just said the other day, he acknowledged that there's 3,000 to 4,000 Russian troops in Ukraine. He said they were on holiday and they just chose to go to Donetsk, instead of some beach to go on holiday to fight. Let's be honest here. Nobody goes on holiday fully armed to Donetsk without permission from the authorities in Russia. Anybody that understands the way the military works there understands that. Second, again, the new front that has opened up in the southeast, marching towards the city of Mariupol, it's very obvious that there are new weapons, artillery, tanks being used there. Where else do they come from but Russia? Maybe we should have better intelligence and better transparency. And I always encourage my colleagues in the government to release as much information as possible to the callers concerned. But that just doesn't happen out of nowhere. Remember, the rebels were losing just 2 weeks ago in Donetsk and Luhansk. Something changed, and I think that it's very obvious that was new hardware from Russia. And with respect to the debate, I would just encourage your listeners, if you want to see a real live debate about these issues from various perspectives, follow me on Twitter, @McFaul. It's happening every single day, and you'll see the Russian perspective alive and well in full debate every day.
Well, speaking of Twitter, I want to read a few tweets that have been coming in, but let me first read an online comment apropos of what we've just been discussing. This is Ellis who writes, "Again, we hear a completely one-sided discussion, which of course supports the U.S.-NATO narrative of events in Ukraine. May I point your listeners to a very powerful article by Mike Whitney from just this past weekend on Counterpunch. Pay particular attention to the video by the military commander of the rebel forces in Donetsk. He states in the video that commanders on both sides of the civil war were trained at the Russian military academy. He also describes how his forces were organized. Lastly, it's clear that the defeat that has been inflicted on the Kiev military has been nothing less than catastrophic. A force of thousands of Kiev troops was completely destroyed, leaving 200 survivors." Another listener writes, "I find it amazing that some people still like the work of Barack Obama. Putin's expansion into Ukraine is a direct result of Obama's weakness. Each time Obama fails to push back against Putin, Putin goes a little bit further." And Philip emails, "Haven't heard anyone make the comparison of Russians in Ukraine with Nazi Germany before World War II. Philip, there have been a number of those, if I may say, but he says where Hitler claimed he was just protecting ethnic Germans in Austria, Sudetenland, and Czechoslovakia. Here's another comment from a Twitter, from a tweet from Paula, who says, "Putin's objectives aren't murky." I had used that word before. "Only his rhetoric is." Another tweet says, "The sanctions have had little effect on Putin's attacks on Ukraine. When will the U.S. and EU countries back Ukraine with arms?" And Owen tweets, "What of MH17? MH17 is gone from the headlines, and it seems there will be no further investigation or consequences for Russia." Another email. Frank says, "The trend of history does seem to be that nationalism is breaking down and a new global model is evolving where communications and travel have begun to change the way people think of their identity. Already, many groups of people think and act internationally and borders have lost their significance. Putin, on the other hand, seems to be a czarist throwback to an age with a vision of national greatness. Putin seems so out of touch with current historical reality." Anyone comment? Either you gentlemen, Ned Walker or Mike McFaul? On some of these comments you're hearing here?
Well, my only comment is I'm glad that public debate is still alive and well, in, at least in the Bay Area.
Rest assured, yes. Mike McFaul?
Oh, there was a lot there, Michael. I don't know where to begin. Other than to say, I guess I'd pick up on two things. One is you see now the West is blamed for doing too much. And the West is blamed for doing too little. In the smorgasbord of comments you just read, it's all the West's fault. But either we're too weak or we're pushing too hard. And I would just remind people to think about what changed between 2010, 2011, and this current crisis that brought this on. I was in the government for 5 years. I'll tell you honestly, NATO expansion didn't come up once. I was at every meeting that the president had with President Medvedev, Prime Minister Putin, then President Putin, and I listened in on most of the phone calls for 3 years at least when I was at the White House. We were talking about a lot of other issues. NATO expansion was not one of them. To the other comment that Obama is weak and this is all his fault because he didn't do enough, I would just remind your listeners that every time Kremlin leaders, I didn't say Russian because they weren't all Russian, Kremlin leaders sat around a table and decided, okay, we're going to use military force in Eastern Europe. What is going to be the American response? The answer has always been there's not going to be a response. Whether we're talking about Georgia in 2008 when George W. Bush was there, the crackdown on Solidarity in December 1981 when Ronald Reagan was president, I don't think anybody would accuse him of being soft on the communists, Or all the way back to Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1956. He ran as president on a pledge to roll back communism in Eastern Europe. And when Soviet tanks rolled into Hungary, there was not a military response. And Democrat, Republican, strong, weak, I think the history has been pretty consistent over the last 70 years. The real interesting question is not how weak or strong they were to deny the use of power, but how they responded afterwards. And here I think, you know, the president should get some credit for responding, I think, not in some crazy way, but in putting in place costs for bad behavior in the heart of Europe.
And the criticisms that you keep hearing that the president has kind of checked out where Russia is concerned, he ought to be more concerned about it and is not concerned enough?
Well, you hear that, but, you know, I know I'm just one-sided and Obama administration official. I get all that. Sometimes, though, 2 + 2 has to equal 4, irrespective of whether you're at Stanford or Berkeley, Democrat, Republican. After the invasion of Georgia, do you know how many people were sanctioned in the Russian government? Guess. How many people ended up on a list? Zero. Zero. The Obama administration, to their credit, has put many people, including the chief of staff of President Putin, by the way, on the sanctions list and sanctions companies. Number two, they have bolstered the NATO alliance. And three, they've helped out the Ukrainians. That's at least showing that there are costs to doing these kind of military interventions.
They've come to the end of the hour. Thank you, Ambassador McFaul. Thank you, Professor Walker. Thanks also to David Stern of the BBC. And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Welcome back our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and thank him and thank our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, engineers Danny Bringer, and for all of us at KQED Public Radio, thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.